this idea of visionary and integrator are really two important roles. But what you've got is a team working in a circle, like everybody's got a point. It isn't a pyramid. It's not like you're at the top, you're the best, you're making all the decisions, and then you're trying to make people below you do everything. You are in a circle and everybody has a circular team-like relationship. It's interdependent.
Hello and welcome to the Gross Profit Podcast. My name is James Kennedy. I'm the CEO and co-founder at procurementexpress.com. We take the hassle out of managing your company spend with magical features, but we're not going to talk about that today. Instead, I've invited along someone I've admired and been in contact with for a number of years now, runs a SaaS business based out of the UK, spends a lot of time giving thought leadership on a range of different areas, everything from leadership to running a company, being profitable. And it's the last topic which I've invited Bridget along to speak with us today about profitability, running a profitable business, something that is suddenly fashionable again in early 2024, given the SaaS chaos that's happening in the market. So Bridget, thanks a million for coming along. I'm very excited to chat to you. Maybe you could just introduce yourself a little bit and give us a bit of your background before we get into leadership and profitability.
Thanks very much, James. Thank you for inviting me. So as you said, I run a company called You Can Book Me. We do online scheduling. So we are a scheduling tool managing people's appointments online, the book a demo, sales teams, customer success teams, any kind of customer or client that needs to book time with you could use a tool like You Can Book Me. We've been doing it for about 12 years. So we're bootstrapped and done it over a longer time. So we've grown to about $5 million ARR. We're profitable, have been for a long time. I know you've got questions on that. And we run a remote company. So we're sort of fairly international. We have people working for us in Europe and North America. Love talking about how to run companies. It's something I've been doing for the last 12 years. So I've got as much to learn as I have to offer advice to anybody as well.
You have an unusual background as a SaaS founder, and I'm bringing it up because I want to talk about it later. So maybe you could just tell us about what was your passion in life today and what was it before you ran You Can Book Me?
So because we're bootstrapped, that means that we didn't take on any institutional funding. We didn't take any VC or anything else. We started very slowly. And so previous to that, I did actually have another career. I worked in politics for a long time. So I worked in the UK Parliament. I've worked in UK local government and in devolved administrations as well. As a special advisor, I've worked as a political advisor, and I've run campaigns inside politics. And I did all of that very happily for about 15 years. And then my co-founder, my husband, Keith, is a developer. He started the web applications in around 2003. So well before I started to run You Can Book Me. And what we saw was really over about 5 year period, a transference of what we could achieve, impact that we could have. And I realized I could have more impact if I ran a software company than if I worked in politics. So I switched, and then I did a little bit of both for a couple of years. And then in 2012, switched full time to running the company.
So you mentioned impact there. I heard, I think it was Jason Cohen recently on Twitter talking about, you know, the reason to become profitable is so that you can have impact.
Yeah.
And that's the whole purpose of it. So are there any parallels between thinking about how you should run a country and how you should run a company?
Absolutely. I think about it all the time, as you wouldn't be surprised to know. What would I do if I ran the world? I think that it's all about systems. I was interested in politics because I was basically interested in the electoral system. It gets very nerdy very quickly. But in the UK, we have this ridiculous voting system, first past the post, which means that when you vote at an election, you don't get a result which is proportionate to the votes that were cast. And it just seems to me such an iniquitous thing to have in a system. You have political parties exercising disproportionate power over everybody else. And it's annoying. You know, it's not legitimate. It would be, you know, in sort of political philosophical terms, it's not legitimate, I don't think. So I suppose I'm interested in the legitimate exercise of power. And so when you run a company, when you run a business, a product, I've applied a lot of the same kind of things, which is, how do we stay accountable? What is a good organization? How are you fair to people? What is the transactional value of working with other people in a group? There's so many read acrosses to that. And then how governments run countries. And I do think that the major issues with the way that countries are run is that too much information is held by discrete groups of people who then don't have accountable responsibilities to other people. They're not legitimately held, for example, they're secretive and they're corrupt. And like corrupt, not in a everybody's taking bribes, but corrupt as in there is a system that if you don't have the opportunity to participate in it, you have no opportunity to change it. So it's kind of fundamentally unfair to the vast, vast majority of people. So a really good example in the UK is that if you go to private school, and there's only about 7 to 9% of people in the country go to private school, you are disproportionately represented in all of the governing groups inside the country. So, you know, you have Parliament, Whitehall, the whole of the cabinet. The vast majority of those people have either been to private school or work alongside all those circles, like the high universities, for example. So if you don't go to private school, you're at an immediate, especially if you don't go to a boys' private school, you're at an immediate disadvantage. And it is structural. So you could say the same thing about hiring people, for example, inside a software company. You know, just before we started recording, we were talking about countries like Argentina and countries which are desperately trying to get economic growth going. And they've got people working there that have just as many skills, just as talented, but because they're not born in North America, or they're not born in a country in Europe, it is much harder to break into working for these wealthy software companies. So you have the same thing, which is how can you be successful as a group overall by bringing in as many diverse talents as you possibly can, making the situation fair, making it a fair playing field, and obviously avoiding all of the usual things around discrimination and making good decisions with as maximum information as possible. So that's what I'm interested in fundamentally. And originally I was interested in it through understanding how democracy works, understanding how parliament and decision making works. And now I'm interested in terms of running a capitalist, you know, profit-driven software company. But it's there's a lot of parallels.
Well, the analogy I see there is that, if I'm not wrong, the UK is the world's oldest democracy, and it was designed, whatever, before most of them, or all of them, maybe.
Oldest, I would say, would probably be, you're talking 2,000 years ago. I think what they say is the parliament is the mother of all parliaments. There's a kind of parliamentary system that started in Britain, which certainly does have very old tenure in the world of political systems, definitely.
And now more modern democracies have whatever fancier voting systems, etc. That kind of makes sense. Same thing happens in the US, I guess, with the college system that they have there. It was just practicality formed a lot of the function. That also fascinates me about a company. Like, companies are effectively have not changed, as far as I know. They're in the original state. You have the owners and the shareholders, and then, like, as you mentioned, you have to try and effectively compete against other companies and outperform them. But the structures haven't changed. We all have boards. More or less, we have a CEO. Some of them have co-CEOs. I'm not sure how well that works out. Is that the only structure you've considered? Because you are CEO there of about 15 people, I think.
I don't have a board, though. Well, I am the board.
You are the board. Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Me and Keith, we are the board. I do have a board, but it is just me and Keith. Corporate law changes all the time. There is a difference between a public company and a private company, certainly. I think you could see culturally a lot has changed. So the way companies operate based on management of information and knowledge, that's changed because of the internet. That's changed because of office cloud tools. Everybody's got email. So there's a whole load of stuff where if you look at the 1950s, office where, you know, you had those pods and somebody's walking up and down with there's a tea lady. Well, at least in Britain, there'd be a tea lady, and it's men, and they're behind, you know, little offices, and they've got their desks, and they've got secretaries, and they are doing work. You know, obviously that's not the same now. So you could say culturally, companies have changed a lot. Corporately, from a legal standpoint, there's obviously a lot of change inside accountability for boards. There's anti-money laundering. There's a whole load of whistleblowing requirements. Like, actually, boards now legally are required to report a lot more in the way that companies are run. I think it's what I find really interesting is the intersection between government and very, very large companies. When companies become so huge, they have this kind of sovereign state that then countries find it very difficult to challenge. So a really good example, as we're talking now, last week, the bosses of the five largest tech companies, Google, Snap, Facebook, Meta, Alphabet, and Discord, randomly, I don't know why he was in there. Anyway, those guys were giving evidence to the Judicial Affairs Senate Committee in Congress in the United States. And it's absolutely fascinating because these five people together represent trillions of value for the world, not just North America or the USA, but the world, trillions of dollars of enterprise value for their companies, but then also for all of the business ecosystems that rely on those distribution channels, because it's all about advertising. We're all spending thousands of pounds on advertising on those channels. Social and political organization happens on those channels. So we're having a national conversation via Facebook and Twitter and Google. We are publishing all of our information on websites that are being distributed by Google and those other companies. And so they have, if you deconstruct it, they have an enormous amount of power, enormous. And so you've got these senators who are struggling to work out why, you know, the sort of the grief of a parent or any adult that has suffered the harm that potentially social media could cause. They're desperately trying to work out how, as policymakers, how as politicians, can we say to a parent, we're going to change the law, or we're going to represent you because you voted for us in a political system, in a legitimate democratic system. You voted for us. We can see, just like you don't want to die of food poisoning in a restaurant, and we can pass a law to stop restaurants from being unclean and poisoning food. How are we going to pass a law that is going to stop this horrific thing happening where young people are being affected by harms distributed in these social media giants? And there isn't an obvious answer, because the social media giants can turn up and give the evidence, and they can say, we can follow your corporate law. We can do everything you tell us to do, but you can't tell us not to do something that you haven't thought of. So if we invent something like social media, politicians haven't thought of it, it's then disseminated out there into the world, the social and political impact happens, and the power and the money goes back to the people that own the company, not the politicians, not the guys that are running the country. I can describe it like the way companies run. We are very small microcosms of power. So we have a certain amount of power. If we run our companies, you are a co-founder, I'm a co-founder, I have a 50% stake in my company. I have a certain amount of power over other people, and I have a certain amount of power over the money that we make and over what we do and the things that we say. And that's the same for absolutely every human being. But then you become, if you have a company that makes so much money, you have this disproportionate amount of power. The power that you have eventually goes beyond the reach of legitimate democratic lawmakers. That is the situation. Nobody can get Mark Zuckerberg now at this stage. In fact, I suspect that some of those people couldn't even change now what's in their companies, because their companies are so huge. They are the size of some countries in many cases. And as a result, they probably haven't worked out how do they control some of the stuff that their tools do. And then there's AI. So I don't think we've got time to talk about.
Before you even get it further, no, the law of unintended consequences is not what they call it. These systems are so massively complicated that you could never predict, even if you could. This is where it becomes so tricky. It's the old tax debate. Like, people come up with closed-end tax loopholes, and then other ones pop up, and it's just the system is rigged for self-interest, I guess, ultimately, you know. If I were to guess from what you said there, you know, you want to create impact in the world. How do you feel about having power over the people in your company? It bothers me sometimes that I just have this job, and so-called what I have power over people in the company. It doesn't sit easily with me. How does it sit with you?
You see, there's a difference between, you know, a power grab, influence, and leadership. And you've just got to combine hopefully all of them except for a power grab. But the point is that, you know, leadership does need power and influence, and you just need to balance the two. You've got to get over being an employer. You've got to get over the fact that you're paying people to do stuff, and you have to celebrate the fact that you can pay people to do stuff better than you would ever be able to do it yourself. So you can't be some kind of megalomaniac as if ideally you would do everything yourself. No, I think you have to celebrate the consequences of being able to build a team. You have to celebrate the consequences of building a team, employing people over a long period of time, creating economic stability for them in their lives. It's something that we always celebrate. It's lovely to see people, you know, move into new houses and have babies and get married and, you know, go traveling, doing the things that they want to do. I always celebrate that as a function of the fact that I run a company that enables them to do it. So you have to look for the reasons why it's a good thing. I think you have to stay accountable. So I talk a lot about the way we run You Can Book Me. If new people join the company, like a finance manager, an HR manager, anybody inside operations, I've always been proud of the fact that they have seen You Can Book Me being run exactly as it should be, in a fair way that's fair to people. you know, rather than you can't be a mini dictator, you can't just run your own personal life through your business. So my personal finances, my personal operations are always separate from my business operations. And I think that's a good way of thinking of it, that I'm an employee of You Can Book Me. I work for You Can Book Me. It's my job. So that company is a different thing from the fact that I'm a founder and I own it. I think that what I've done more over the last 5 or so years, I've just networked more. And obviously people like you, James, I've known you for about 6 years now. I think we first met at MicroConf, didn't we? Meeting people, reaching out, being open, sharing. You know, you then, I think meeting other founders, other people who are running their companies, it kind of equalizes the problems, because the tendency would be to take on too many problems yourself, thinking that you've caused them, which is a kind of a narcissistic tendency. Every founder has some form of narcissism because we are putting ourselves out there, let's face it. But I think that the negative side of that is that you then tend to blame yourself for absolutely everything. And you have to protect yourself. And one of the ways I found is talking to other people about the issues that I am dealing with. It is amazing when other people go, oh, yeah, yeah, no, I dealt with that a few years ago. Or, that's a problem I recognize. Or this is how you do with that. Or I can see instantly what's going on here and I can fix it or help you. You know, these are things that realize that you're not alone yourself as a founder. So you shouldn't think of yourself as being the be all and end all. In fact, you're just another person doing a job. I think of leadership kind of as a circle, and right next to leadership is operations and execution. So the book I've read this summer, which I should have read years ago, but it was recommended to me, is Traction, Gino Wickman, The Entrepreneur's Operating System. I know you do it. I should have read it years ago. I don't know. I didn't, James. But anyway, but, you know, this idea of visionary and integrator are really two important roles. But what you've got is a team working in a circle, like everybody's got a point. It isn't a pyramid, is my point. It's not like you're at the top, you're the best, you're making all the decisions, and then you're trying to make people below you do everything. You are in a circle and everybody has a circular team-like relationship. It's interdependent.
You seemed a bit juxtaposed there between, yes, I have power over these people, but you're trying to make it a circle to make it egalitarian. Mm. And I get that. I 100% get that. I just want to know what the rules are. Tell me what the rules are, and then I'll work within that. Sounds like you're setting out the rules nice and clearly.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think that sums it up very well. That's exactly what I think. Just back to AI, though, I have thought about what I would do if I was running the country now that we have AI. But this is quite radical and anarchic, and lawmakers would hate it. What every single government should do, or every single parliament should do, is run the whole of the corpus of law through AI. And so then AI can learn how laws are made, because of course laws go through a whole series of scrutiny and adjustments and amendments and so on. And then in order to draft new law, you should say to the AI, it's just one great big long prompt. You know, I want a law, let's say, I mean, I don't know, dangerous dogs being a really bad example, but I want a law which is going to ban people from using these kind of dogs because they, you know, they're dangerous. The AI would probably come up with better drafted legislation based on all of the previous types of amendments that had been made, with law that would then be a better quality because you could run all the case law through it as well. So what you're trying to do is separate accountability and legitimacy for deciding something is going to be the law, which is a human being job, and how the law gets drafted. And we mix up the two. So we often have highly qualified, creative human beings spending a lot of time trying to draft law. Machines can do that better. AI, I'm absolutely sure, could draft law better. What we're actually looking for is accountability for that law. And my personal view is that we need to do more random selection in our representatives. So we need to grab people, a bit like jury selections. We should create more juries, citizen juries, one way or another, into our decision making. And what you have is you have this pushback from the very people who control the machine to say, oh, no, you need us because we are expert, because we understand, because we have wisdom. So it's not democratic at all. It's a trustee form of representation, the House of Lords being the best example. And it's not giving any agency to people who supposedly don't qualify because of their background. So those are the rules. I've come to the conclusion you're never going to be able to get the people who control the rules to change them, unfortunately. So it has to be changed from outside in.
I think in Ireland we have a citizens' assembly, which is some version of that. On AI, yeah, this morning, as we were prepping for this interview, I was prepping this morning, I spent about 20 minutes prepping, not that long. And then I just thought I'd ask GPT, hey, what should I ask Bridget Harris, CEO of You Can Book Me? And it pushed out a load of questions that are way better than the ones I was working on, which was, annoying and equal part annoying. I guess maybe I should have just started with that, but there you go.
You should ask ChatGPT what would Bridget Harris answer, and then we could get AI just to do the entire interview and then we're done. Then we could go for a drink.
10:15 here in the morning, but I'm Irish, so I can do that anytime you want. The structure that we're given is that companies, their purpose, a lot of people say, is to create profit, not necessarily impact. Do you agree with that? And is profit over enterprise value your target? When you can book me or maybe not tell me.
Well, I think we need to break down some of those assumptions or terms. So of course, there is in publicly owned companies a responsibility to create value for shareholders. That's a famous thing, often seen as being a very destructive motivation inside companies, because it's not just what they want to do. What they're saying is, we have to do this because our obligation is for the co-owners of the company, i.e. the shareholders, to get a dividend one way or another, or for the value of their shares to go up. We have to do something which is going to serve the people that own the company. And I can see why that's problematic. Because what you're saying is the customers, the people giving the money in the first place to the product or service of the company, are secondary to the beneficiaries. So you can see that there is a, you know, there's a mismatch there. Because then if you take any of those public companies and you look at their marketing content, they're not there saying, we're here to take money from you for us. We're here to give your money to our friends. Then, you know, they're never saying that. They're saying, we love customers. We put customers first. We think customers are great. Please give us your money. And then in a different room, you know, they say, oh, we, by the way, we have a legal obligation to promote the interests of the shareholders, not the customers. So there's a little bit of contradiction there. There's basically a bit of BS going on one way or another. It's also problematic because creating profit also creates taxes and obligations. And often, so you get, you know, a company like Amazon, who didn't create profit for a very, very long time. And I think, and I don't know, I mean, I'm absolutely happy to be corrected here, but my assumption is, because Jeff Bezos used to talk about it all the time, that Amazon never created a profit, that it was just to avoid paying corporation taxes. Or famously in Ireland, all of the tech companies have come to Ireland because of the incredibly low income tax for companies. So they've established themselves in Ireland because they're paying a fraction of the rates. So there's a kind of corporate interest to not pay taxes to government. But that's not the same thing as companies not creating value for either customers or employees. So you could say that there were thousands of people that benefited from having a good job at Amazon. I know this is not necessarily for everybody. You know, there's obviously controversies about warehouse workers and so on. But for the executives in Amazon's headquarters over the many, many years, everybody's got a good wage from Amazon. Everybody's got healthcare from Amazon. And then we've all bought loads of stuff from Amazon. There's been loads of buyers and sellers on Amazon Marketplace. There's been a lot of commerce that has happened on Amazon. So it's too simplistic to say, oh, he hasn't made any profit, therefore somehow he's running the company into the ground. He's actually created billions of dollars of enterprise value that has then gone straight back into the experience of employees and customers. He hasn't created a profit for governments to take a slice of it through taxation, or for there to be a profit that is then just going to be paid out to shareholders as a dividend. He's obviously supplied enterprise value through the share price value as opposed to the dividend. So it's a bit of a more of a nuanced argument about what should companies do. I think it's possible for companies to make too much profit, make too much money, and not reinvest it back into the value of the service or the goods that they are selling. And so by that, I mean, you can essentially run some kind of scam operation. I mean, the worst example would be of a Spectrum where you're taking lots of money from somebody and you're not giving them the service back. So it's 100% profit because you're not spending any of it. Apple have got like billions and billions and billions of dollars in the bank in cash. I mean, they've got like $500 billion of cash in the bank. It just feels like an extraordinary large amount of money. You know, that's a cash mountain. And that I would wonder, what is that for? What's happening there? Because you're creating that for what? A generational industrial strategy inside Apple or something. So I think that you can make too much money through profit. You can pay your taxes. And then what are you going to do with that profit? Because money itself doesn't have any actual philosophical or existential value. I'm not trying to think of the right word. You know, it doesn't mean anything. It is whatever we say it's for that has the meaning. This money is for something. Otherwise, it's just a number. So I think that in terms of impact, you can have a lot of impact without creating profit. You don't have to create profit to create impact. You can create impact by running a good company, offering a product that customers want, offering a great service to customers, employing people who like working for you, and feeling like your little part of the world is well looked after, well tended, and that is impact. Because if you think about so many businesses that are badly run, that don't create any good jobs for people, that offer crap goods and services, that don't, you know, aren't operating inside the marketplace in a functioning way, then your impact is just not to be crap. Is your impact is just to be run a good business. It's honest work. You know, that's the point. On top of that, though, and I have thought about this having been bootstrapped for so many years, I've realized the profound difference between running a bootstrap profit-driven company where when we do create profit, we do profit share, for example, with our team members, but we can also reinvest profit back into other projects and so on, that creates a wider impact that's still very much within our control, versus being motivated by growth as opposed to profit. So we would have taken all of our profit, and you can book me, and just spent it all on growth for the equivalent effect. You could have got a much, much bigger company, but then what you're really looking for is to get money back through the value of your shares. So some kind of exit. So if you're doing that, the value of your shares really, really matters. So if you got let's say just for the sake of the math, a $1 million company, and you want to sell your company for $10 million, then you're making $9 million. It's an amazing amount of money to make, but your $1 million company needs to be worth that. You can't sit there and go, well, I want to essentially make, just drive forward entirely all about profit and not be able to achieve my goal of growth.
Amazon, for example, you had the example you had there. They're trying to grow the value of their shares, not necessarily cash flow, right?
Yeah.
In the early years. So if I invested up $1 a share, really, Bezos was trying to get his share to $10 so I can get a return. So he's really, his motivation there is driven by investors, exactly like you've said. There's a contrast between, that seems like the incentives are totally set up wrong. And yet, if you were to ask any, let's say, as Milei, the Argentinian president might say, a collectivist group, let's say a government, to set up something like Amazon, which delivers insane value, definitely a good portion of it to my doorstep, at least almost daily at this stage, it just couldn't be done. So there's some sort of contrast, even though between logically, the incentives are set up incorrectly for societal benefit, you might say.
Yeah.
But then Amazon, it's hard to imagine a single business that's created as much impact. I suppose if you're the local store that's been put out of business, you might have a different view on that.
Yeah.
But net, I feel like the world is better with Amazon than without it.
I think that's where corporate law does come in. I think that's where anti-competition, sort of monopoly laws come in. And I think that's where governments are really struggling in the world of technology, where technology is advancing faster. Their brains literally cannot keep up with the potential and the possibility of all of the changes. But I completely agree with you. I mean, I think it's self-evident that the old collectivist models of economic transactional value, so that governments were controlling supply, basically, and demand was being suppressed to a point where supply was only being given out in an egalitarian or equal way, where the demand was being controlled and defined in advance. So there's no independent demand and no independent supply. Now, that is going to suppress a capitalist marketplace model. And, you know, even China, I think, understands, even if China still operates an incredibly dictatorial regime and very, in many ways, very collectivist in the way it handles things, it is selling in a capitalist market. It is benefiting directly from capitalism. There's no doubt about that. That's where Russia has really, really struggled recently, because the whole world has said that they've stopped buying. There's no government in the world that can keep controlling supply and demand in a collectivist way and try to ignore capitalism. I mean, it's out there, it's working.
Well, I should actually reference two other podcasts I've done that are relevant to this stage, or I'm not doing my job, which is, if you're interested in using Ireland to reduce your tax base, I interviewed Eamon O'Sullivan, who's an accountant based here in Ireland, and corporate tax structures is something that he helps foreign customers with. Interesting, Jens Meyer, Dr. Jens Meyer, he worked for a subsidiary of Bosch, and their company was sold to a Chinese company. And it was fascinating listening to him talk about why this Chinese company was so successful. Like, they had a R&D shift system. So they had R&D, but they did it 24 hours a day because they wanted to accelerate their R&D. And I had this view of, you know, China quasi-communist, but oh my God, that sounds like hard work to me. Like, the reason they're winning, whatever way they set up the incentives, they're just working super hard, you know, which is getting the benefit. Okay, so I want to bring it to something that really stuck with me, Bridget, from you years ago, which was that clearly you're walking the talk here. You're saying there's such a thing as too much profit, and you have a profit share sometimes, let's say, with your employees. How did you structurally organize your company to focus on cash flow versus enterprise value?
Not spending any money. just really simple. Actually, I'm glad you've asked that question, because in the questions you sent me, the question was, what did I read in the first, like the business hero, like what did I do in the first place to prioritize profit? And I was thinking about that, and there wasn't anything I read or did about profit. It was about cash flow. So I think that when you are starting a business, you just have to take care of cash flow. It's about the amount of money that you have in your bank. No other conversation about ROI or investment, you know, returns or speculation is as visceral as how much money you have in your bank account. So in the early days, be very careful about who you give money to and what decisions that they're going to take on your behalf, because that's where your money is going to go. We did a lot of working along the side. As I said at the beginning, you know, we had other jobs, we were doing other things to supplement our own personal income. So we didn't get paid from You Can Book Me for quite a few years. We certainly didn't get paid an awful lot or draw out any dividends or profit for a very long time. You have to be patient, and you have to tell the team, you know, what your plan is and where you're going with this, and keep everybody on track. So I prioritize culture over salaries. So even if people weren't getting huge salaries, they were getting a great culture working for You Can Book Me. And so, for example, I didn't prioritize setting insane targets and numbers and trying to beat everybody through OKRs every week. You know, when you're thinking, well, actually, this is quite a fragile business and we're bootstrapped and we're having to take care of every single customer. It's a very emotional way to start off. At the beginning, I toned down some of the business driven, profit driven, money driven things. I kept that on my side of the plate. And what the team knew about was that we were building scheduling software. We had these customers coming in, and it was all really exciting, and we had a great culture, and we were building up new things in the way that people were doing their jobs that they hadn't done before, like working remotely. And it was fun. So I did all of that, hiding the fact that I was like a hawk looking at my daily deposits from Stripe and managing to the penny what we were spending. So you just have to manage your money like an absolute hawk. There's no other way. And then once you've understood that, you can then drive forward. Profit comes from being able to do the same thing on a repeated basis without increasing costs. So money in, money out isn't profitable. You know, money in and then 10 times of output out as a result is profit.
So it sounds like you took a bit of a Wizard of Oz approach there, which is you took on a lot of that financial management, and everyone just focuses on their job and the culture, actually. So you don't bring the money into the wider focus for the team, and they just focus on the culture that you wanted to build. I want to finish up with my favorite question, which is who's your business hero?
Because I'm a narcissist, I don't have any heroes. However, but also like business heroes, it's problematic, because every business hero, when they become very successful, they've always got skeletons in the cupboard. They're always flawed one way or another. But I think it's like, who do I admire? Like, who are the people that I find inspiring? So people like Richard Branson, people like Oprah Winfrey, it's the tenacity of being incredibly successful in what you do, even when you've had knockbacks, even when people have told you, you know, that you're never going to amount to anything. And then, you know, how many ever times did Richard Branson get bankrupted and he's still around? You know, the kind of story that Oprah Winfrey has is just so inspiring. And then other leaders, other people like, you know, Nelson Mandela, people who've just kept going. And I think that what I find really inspiring are stories of tenacity and resilience, and people who just believe in themselves. Because you don't, obviously, I'm joking, I'm not, don't think I'm actually a narcissist, but you have to have a certain level of self-confidence, of cockiness, but you have to have belief you can do it. And so I enjoy reading stories of people who have believed in themselves. They appear to be kind of quite nice people. So I'd like to meet them. I'd like to meet Richard Branson. I'd like to meet Oprah Winfrey.
Well, no one can disagree with that. Richard Branson comes up more than once. And I think it's the lifestyle. He has such a rock star lifestyle. Seems to be having such fun.
Yeah.
You know, it seems like he has no care in the world. Like he's doing all these amazing things and he's doing it with a smile on his face. Yeah. It looks good to me. Bridget, you're a star. I could literally listen to you all day long. Thanks a million for coming along today. How can people reach out to you, or where should they follow more of your output?
Definitely the only real place I'm on is LinkedIn. Bridget Harris is on LinkedIn. I'm, you know, it's the LinkedIn URL with Bridget Harris. I'm quite easy to find, and my DMs are open. So I'd love to get any feedback from people listening to the podcast. Thanks so much for having me on.
This was a fascinating discussion. If you would like more discussions like this, maybe mixing in, I hate to say the word politics, but mixing in wider topics from society into how it applies to business, I'd love to hear your suggestions. You can email me, james.kennedy@procurementexpress.com, and we'll see you in the next one.